6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning.
Hello and welcome to A Public Affair. It's Tuesday, so that means I'm your host today, Carousel Baird. Thanks for tuning in. In 2011, hundreds of thousands of people descended on the Wisconsin State Capitol. Some of you, I assume, may remember those protests. Needless to say, those thousands of people who literally occupied the State Capitol did not have a permit to do so. In the wake of those protests, Governor Scott Walker's administration created rules to regulate when and how and why you could assemble at the state capitol. There are many provisions to those rules which were developed by the state's Department of Administration and included a rule requiring groups of four or more to get a permit any time they assembled for an event at the capitol. And violation of those rules would result in a civil fine and a ticket, and in fact, tickets actually were issued in the past several years. The ACLU sued the state, arguing that those rules violated the citizens' First Amendment rights. So today we have as our guest attorney Stephen Porter. He represented the plaintiff alongside with the ACLU in bringing forth those First Amendment claims to the federal court. And on July 8th, Judge William Connolly issued a preliminary injunction declaring part of the rules unenforceable. A pretty beautiful First Amendment success. It's rare to get First Amendment successes sometimes these days. And that was a good injunction that was issued. So today we have attorney Stephen Porter with us. He is a civil rights lawyer here in Madison. He's been here for more than 30 years working on employment and workers' rights, First Amendment rights, criminal justice rights. He's a graduate of UW Law School. And he's been named a top discrimination rights attorney by Madison Magazine, and he has served on the ACLU board and has served as chair of the State Bar of Wisconsin Individual Rights and Responsibility Section, a whole plethora of huge successes. So it's really an honor to have a civil rights champion here in the studio with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Carousel.
All right, well, let's get us started. Can you tell us, Steve, a little bit about the story of this case? Basically, a member of the Solidarity Sing-Along was concerned that with these new rules, he was hesitant to participate as a member of the Solidarity Sing-Along because he didn't want to get fined and ticketed and be assessed a violation by the state.
Well, the story actually goes back further than that, back to the time of the protests and the earlier stages of the sing-along. And in December of 2011, the DOA announced that it intended to issue a access policy that would interpret the existing administrative rules for using all public facilities, really, of the state, but specifically focused on the Capitol. And the police chief at that time was Charles Tubbs, and a lawyer named Mark Herman from the Department of Administration began contacting Chris Reeder, who was sort of the recognized leader, very informally, of the sing-along at the time, and encouraged him to meet to discuss the possibility of the sing-along applying for a permit. And there had been a number of lawyers who had been loosely surrounding the sing-along and providing, insights to them. And Chris asked who to contact about that, and he contacted me. And I got a copy of the original version of the rules, which were issued on December 1st, and which the DOA announced would not begin to be enforced, I think, till the 19th or something like that of December. And they held listening sessions and whatnot for the public to discuss the new rules. And in the meantime, Mark Herman and I met on several occasions and sort of quietly on the side and had a number of very intense discussions about the rules and what I thought were problems with them. And in the process, I was also taking input from Larry Dupuy, the legal director of the ACLU of Wisconsin, and other lawyers, Lester Pines and some other lawyers interested in this. And we presented our concerns through me to Mr. Herman, and I want to commend him for being very willing to listen. And ultimately, he made some very significant changes to those rules that took care of quite a few of our concerns, that primarily that had to do with requiring an indemnification that a group, that was responsible. It had questions about the limits of the responsibility for people who held rallies and things like that, and how much they would have to pay for any damages or injuries that were caused, and whether there'd be an advance payment and things like that. And we worked out a whole bunch of that, but couldn't get past the requirement of a permit and couldn't get past the four-person threshold for rallies. So on December 16th, there was a version, the revised version of the rules went into effect, but there were no arrests. They were not enforced, I think largely because the DOA figured this would all go away after the recall election in June.
There were some arrests, but it didn't happen at that time. Not arrests, but there were tickets.
Not for the permits, not for lack of a permit.
For other reasons, there were tickets issued.
Apparently so. I wasn't really very much involved in that.
Okay.
When it became clear, that the sing-along was going to continue its activities after the recall election, I can't speak for the DOA, but things changed. Chief Tubbs was no longer there, and a new police chief, Chief David Irwin, was installed.
Mm-hmm.
And
different philosophy of how to approach it.
And in September, he announced, at least according to the papers, that he was going to enforce the rules. And I believe it was September of 2012 they did start doing that. The lawyers convened again, and ultimately the ACLU decided to bring suit, and had somehow come across Michael Kissick, who is my client. And Michael Kissick is an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin in the School of Medicine, and he's a scientist, and some of the work and the grants that he applies for require security clearances, and so he was very concerned about not having any legal prosecutions mm-hmm. on his record. So when they started enforcing, and Michael was kind of a casual attendee of the sing-along. He didn't go regularly, but when he had a chance or had time on the noon hour, he liked to go, and he enjoyed it very much and felt really gratified to be able to express his views. He went one day and noticed people being arrested, when he asked officers what was going on and how could he avoid being arrested or ticketed, he couldn't get an answer at first from his first couple of inquiries. And finally, one officer said, just don't be associated with those people, mm-hmm. pointing to the sing-along. And he left because he couldn't risk getting a citation. And so from that point on, he was chilled, as the legal term is used, from expressing himself politically in conjunction with the informal sing-along that was going on.
And political expression is protected under the First Amendment.
Right. And then the ACLU decided to bring suit and invited me to work with Larry Dupree. So I'm a cooperating attorney with the ACLU.
That's wonderful to hear the whole history behind it, that there was this whole foundation before we even got to the rules that we have now, which still have legal concerns. On some level, it's good to hear that there was conversation and progress being made, and that there can still be conversation and cooperation happening on the Capitol. That's sort of a side note, but that's perhaps a happy piece to this story, is to hear some of that.
Well, let me just say that I think Chief Tubbs, who was the chief during that early period, was a
now
model.
Now I get to work with him at the county.
It was a model of policing, and I think but for him, we would have had some serious incidents through the whole period. But
I think that's what's interesting, too, is so these rules have existed so informally, the idea that the Capitol Police has to overall oversee what happens at the Capitol and protect its safety, but that there had never been any concerns or any conflicts or need for detailed administrative rules before the protests in 2011, and that sort of created this whole new world. And I want to read a piece of one of the administrative rules, which I know that in the lawsuit you guys addressed many things, but one of the pieces that the judge sort of grasped onto, I want to read words from the decision. Here's a quote. The access policy requires the public to apply for a permit in advance of any performance, ceremony, presentation, meeting, rally, organized tour not led by department or staff, festival, reception, or the like held in public area, state facilities, or buildings. Exempted. And then there's a list of several exemptions, one which is any rally, meaning a gathering of people for the purpose of actively promoting any cause inside the Capitol consisting of fewer than four people. So that's the rule is you have to get a permit if you're going to assemble and have an event. And then there's an exception if you're one, two, or three people. So therefore, the Solidarity Sing-Along and any other group that has more than three people would have to get a permit.
Yeah, I mean, the surprising thing really is that the four-person threshold for a rally is actually more lenient than the requirement for any other activity. If there's just one person up there that wants to bring out their guitar and sing in the Capitol, they need a permit.
They need a permit.
Yeah, under the rules.
So what I really like about the judge addressing this, he started with this fabulous section about the importance of the role of the Capitol as a place of expression in public discourse. And I think it is a really nice illustration, lays the foundation for the conversation that the judge has through his decision. So I want to read a little bit of that part of the decision. So quoting from the decision, the massive scale of Wisconsin State Capitol Rotunda is difficult to capture in words alone. Just 3 feet shorter than our nation's capital in Washington, D.C., it is the largest dome by volume in the United States. Who knew that? And one of the largest in the world. Principal architect designed the rotunda to be the center of public interaction among 3 branches of state government, the city, the county and the city, the University of Wisconsin, and the public, by constructing 4 massive wings around it, opening into 4 major streets of the city of Madison, East and West Washington Avenue, which is the central route through the Isthmus, State Street, which leads directly to the heart of the university campus, and Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, where the city and county government are still based. And then in another section, he quotes the state's own National Historic Landmark application describing the Capitol Rotunda. These are in the state's words. The soaring rotunda at the Wisconsin State Capitol is designed to induce its citizenry to be as individuals among the resources of Wisconsin. Whereas some state houses are maintained apart from the urban fabric, the Wisconsin Capitol Rotunda functions both literally and symbolically as a city center and is fully utilized as a public space to which all have claim.
That's fabulous.
What do you think of? I mean, that's not often that judicial decisions
No.
sort of start with this heavy history.
And it's just, it's amazing and it's fantastic. And I was very impressed from the beginning with Judge Conley when, right at the outset of the hearing for the preliminary injunction, he announced to all that he had been born and raised in Madison and grown up loving the Capitol. And he said something to the effect that it was his favorite building in the world, or second favorite or something, and that he was well aware of its dedication at its inception to free speech and open government and public participation.
So perhaps more well aware than everybody else in the city. I mean, that's exciting to even hear some of that.
Not only is it thrilling, but it's very important to a legal decision like this, that those type of findings by this judge will help if this decision were to get challenged and appealed up the road or to be used as precedent later. It sets the basis for some very important legal factual foundations for his decision and for the use of the Capitol in the future.
Well, can facts like this then, it's helpful if it goes to an appeal process that it,
well, not only that, but it's very helpful with regard to any future issue that would come up, whether it's in state court or federal court, concerning the Capitol.
Because you can quote this?
Right, because this would be precedent in the area with regard to federal cases, and it would certainly in many cases, as long as it involved federal civil rights, would also bind the state courts with a finding that it is a forum that is a public forum, which is very critical in legal analysis. But in the end, when he recognized and that it was dedicated, you know, from its very inception for free speech,
the whole design and concept behind it,
and even maybe more importantly, at the end when he recognizes that it's so capacious that it really fits more logically under the cases that pertain to outside public forums like public squares rather than inside administrative office buildings, and which are a little bit more deferential to the government.
I'm Carousel Baird, and I'm sitting here with Stephen Porter. Would welcome anybody's calls today. We are calling in at area code 608-256-2001, or you can call toll-free at area code 866-899-WORT, message on Twitter at WORT Talk, or our Facebook page, A Public Affair, 89.9 FM, Madison. It's a mouthful to get all that right there. So, let's sort of get a little bit to the crux of the judge's decision. You and the ACLU advance several arguments, but the argument that the judge really holds on to is the idea of needing four or more of groups with four or more people needing to get a permit. So the state argues that you have to have permitting on some level to, one, ensure adequate policy resources, and two, manage competing demands, i.e. the idea that if a big group is coming, they need to know that the big group is coming so that if another big group is coming, they can make enough space for them and have enough staff to handle their needs. The judge agrees that these are important points, but doesn't buy connecting that to the reason that people four or more should get a permit.
Exactly. And actually, the judge found that our claims, two of our claims, to have merit. The first was the distinction between a rally and any other type of speech in the Capitol. It had that question, of course, had the unique twist in it that actually greater deference was given to political speech than to other types of speech. And of course, political speech is recognized by the federal courts as the core of the First Amendment and generally what the very purpose of the First Amendment was. So that frankly, I think Mark Herman and those who drafted that policy thought that they were doing a good thing by being more lenient.
It was sort of quirky to read that decision, yeah, and say, hey, DOA, do you know that what you're doing is actually supporting public speech, political speech over other speech?
Well, they did. That was very intentional, and it's to their credit. But the judge said, and we argued, that you can't make those distinctions.
Right.
And that's kind of a technicality, and it's really not pertinent, I think, to the main issue of how the capital gets used. The second issue is, but that says, you know, there's two types of cases that or situations the judge has to look at. One is, do the policies or the regulations, are they based on the content of the speech? And he determined that when you distinguish between a rally and other types of speech, then you are making a decision based on the content of the speech, which is given strict scrutiny, it's very suspect under First Amendment analysis. And all First Amendment analysis, all analysis of our Bill of Rights, is based on a balancing of the interests of the state in the efficient administration of government versus the interests of the public or the individual in their rights, which in this case is to free expression. The way that those decisions are made by the courts or analyzed by the courts is through a form of scrutiny, and there's strict scrutiny, intermediate scrutiny, and rational basis scrutiny. The scrutiny involved in content-based speech is strict scrutiny, which basically requires and all of the levels of scrutiny involve an ends and a means test. So.
And those are, for the non-lawyers out there, those are sort of different kind of tests depending on the court sort of reasoning how important a right is.
Exactly.
The more important a right is, the more likely the court is going to say you have to prove extra levels to justify denying this right.
Right.
And First Amendment right gets the highest because it's part of the Constitution.
Right. So for the content-based, for any type of regulation that affects, that's based on the content of the speech, you have to, a government, in order to regulate content base in a speech must have a compelling state interest is the legal term, and they must use means that are narrowly tailored to only achieve that interest and are not overbroad. That applies to the content-based, and basically what the judge decided with regard to the rally versus other forms of speech is that the state had not stated a compelling state interest for that distinction, and they hadn't shown that the means that they chose were narrowly tailored to
they
any
could
state
do it
interest.
In a more narrow way. Now, we do have a caller, so
all right.
Thanks for hanging in there. Hi, caller. Will you state your name and your question?
Thomas, my comment and question is, you will note the judge limited the number of people to 21 people, pardon me, to 20, don't want 20 people. And in effect, the state has already said they will, anyone that's over, if there's more than 21, they'll throw them out of there, or what they'll do is they'll arrest them all. And so the point is, it really isn't a win for anybody as far as I can see, because they're limiting the number of people, and the people that came to the solidarity thing, including myself from time to time, would just do it occasionally. We don't. Some do it every day, but most people never did it every day. And so, you know, that's one of the things that I think the judge failed on. So basically now they've got the right to say, well, okay, it looks like he's this person or that person is coming to the thing. We'll just get rid of them all. So I don't think they want anything at all other than stop the tickets from people protesting, but they will still try to see that there's somebody in that space with a permit every day, particularly come start and fall when they have people in there. So don't think that this is much of a win. And then my question is, if the... My question is, the state is going to, of course, appeal this decision, I understand. And so, you know, then if they appeal it, and then the judge, some other judge says, well, okay, you appeal it, and nobody can do anything until the appeal is decided. So I'll listen, take the answer off the air, and thank you for the program.
Thank you, Thomas, for your question. I think that's very valid. To talk, and we have a couple more questions coming on as well, but let's address that for a second. You know, part of this decision, Stephen, is it's a preliminary injunction. It's a step, and maybe we didn't lay that out where I was going to talk about that maybe a little more later, but maybe we should have put that more up front. This is a preliminary injunction, which means before we even have the big conversation and the big trial, the judge already thinks that there's concerns. Can you sort of talk a little bit about that process, and he has that's a future question too. He raises a point about changing 4 to 20. Does that how much of a solution is that? But let's get the first piece first.
Right, Carousel. It is a preliminary injunction. It's not a final judgment in the case. In fact, the case is scheduled for full trial in January, the week of January 13th of next year. The preliminary injunction is in place. Based on a recognition that essentially the plaintiff is in danger of suffering under the legal terminology irreparable harm if the judge doesn't step in at this time and enjoin or restrain the state from enforcing the policies even before a final trial. And so from that point, it's significant because in order to do that, the judge has to decide that the plaintiff has a substantial likelihood of prevailing at the trial. So he's already pretty much said, you know, I think Mr. Kissick is very likely to win once we hear all the evidence at the full trial. And that's not an easy thing to achieve. And secondarily, he said he had to determine that he's in danger of suffering irreparable harm if the state isn't enjoined from enforcing the policies in a way that restrains his rights to speech unconstitutionally. And so from that standpoint, I think those are very significant first steps. And we'll see after the trial what the judge ends up with. I think there's, of course, a lot of discussion about the 20-person threshold and how did he come up with that number. And, you know, I can't obviously go into the mind of Judge Connolly, but the way I would read it is that, and from his decision, is that he chose what essentially I think he would admit is an arbitrary number. And probably the way he addressed this at the preliminary injunction hearing would be illustrative. You know, he mainly was questioning Larry Dupuy and I as the plaintiff's lawyers and said, well, would you acknowledge that there's some number? Because our position was that there shouldn't be a permit system at all, a mandatory permit. There should be a reservation system. But anyway, we can get into that later. But the judge says, well, would you recognize that at a certain number, if you were intending to have thousands of people show up at the Capitol, it would be reasonable for the state to require a permit for that? And we said, well, you know, we'd have to concede there probably would be some number where it would be reasonable.
You have to look a little reasonable.
Yeah.
Right?
And then he said, well, the rule on the outside is 100 people, which we weren't charging or challenging. And so he said, so it's got to be a number less than 100 inside. He just sort of stated
gotcha.
That. And he says, well, what about 75? And he was thinking 75, 50, what number? He put pressure on both sides. What number would you think is reasonable? And we said, well, we aren't going to, we think it should be, there shouldn't be a permit requirement.
Well, and, we have a caller waiting right now, and then I think let's have a conversation about that and
right.
the whole idea of what are you going to do from here.
All right.
You know? So, hi, caller. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. No problem. Thank you. A question a comment.
Can you tell us your name?
Sure. Sorry. I'm Pete from Madison.
Hi, Pete. Thanks.
Hi. Question. So does that mean that from what I'm hearing, I tuned in a little late, that if the group is over 20 inside and over 100 outside, they can eject, remove, arrest in some way or other. Am I understanding that correctly?
Maybe.
Nobody knows. I mean, here's...
I have a comment to follow up.
The judge raised the threshold from 4 for a rally to 20. There are questions abound as to what it means to be a participant. I don't represent the sing-along. I represent Michael Kissick, but I know that the sing-along asserts that it isn't a group, that it's an informal sort of ad hoc occurrence that happens. And so the question of how many people are participating and just a number of questions related to how it would be practically enforced really isn't before the court in our case. Our case is a facial challenge, as it's called, to the actual language of the rules. Later down the road, after we see, once the judge decides on this question, there will still be a building access policy. I'm sure, but at that point, how the DOA and the police enforce it will become the issue, which is called an applied challenge. And if we could show that they're applying even a constitutional policy in an unconstitutional way, for example, if they're using a supposedly neutral policy against groups because of the content of their speech, and that's their intent, then even though the policy is constitutional, their intent is not, and that would be an applied challenge.
So that maybe the answer to Pete's question is that's the next step. This is a piece of it, and that
I think though, Pete, that it's also important. I personally think I know I've heard that the police have announced to some members of the sing along that very soon they're going to be counting numbers, and if you have 21, the judge said they have to announce that you're an illegal assembly and then ask you to leave before they arrest, which is a really good protective mechanism that the judge required. But I personally think that if the state is that nitpicky in enforcing this thing, that unreasonable in enforcing the 20-person threshold, which even the judge seems to present as just an arbitrary temporary threshold, I think that but come January, the judge will not be very happy if they're just arbitrarily cracking down because the number gets to be 21 and there's really no other reason to do it. I think that they would be making a big misstep if they do that. And even though the technical number is there in the ruling, I think the judge really expects the state to be reasonable in how they apply this and that they better have a good purpose for it.
Thank you for that explanation. My very quick follow-up and question then, taking a leaf from what's been done in Turkey with the protests, would it be possible for people to stand across the street from the Capitol, then at which point they're not on Capitol property, but say on something called Freedom Friday, they could then sing and be supportive of the sing-along that's on the Capitol, but yet they're not on Capitol property, so they can't get cited. And I will hang up and take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you for your question.
Right. In fact, Pete,
I would think yes.
Yeah, the judge actually acknowledged the fact that there are alternative places that the sing-along could use to express themselves, including the outside Capitol grounds where there's a 100-person threshold. So, and as I understand it, the sing-along does, one day a week at least, does sing outside. And at that point, up to 100 would be within the rules.
But that's just on the Capitol grounds. Pete's question about could they be across the street?
Well,
they
that's city
be even
probably.
Bigger rate.
Yeah, and well, I don't know what the city
regulates.
I'll get
to work on a county regulation to put a hammer
good for
on
you.
That. Now, so actually, let's talk a little bit about the big question of 4 isn't okay, but as at least for the moment, 20 is okay. So I wanted to read a little bit of the judge's decision on, you know, what's interesting is the judge's decision is very encouraging and very hopeful to almost think that he's going to say no number is okay. Let's read a little bit of it. It says, the defendants offer very little in the way of a nexus between strict permitting requirements for small groups and the significant state interest of maintaining peace and order in the Capitol. For example, the Capitol Police do not need a permit violation to arrest or remove an individual troublemaker from the building. They can deal with disruptive behavior by enforcing a variety of current state statutes. Of course, police can function more effectively and muster more quickly when they know ahead of time a disturbance is likely to occur. However, the vast majority of events at the state capitol, in contrast, don't require extraordinary police presence. In the absence of a disturbance, that would seem to be particularly true of smaller events. I really like the point that he's making of, yes, you want to make sure there's no chaos, but there's no relationship to the groups being there and trouble happening. One person, there's other parts in the decision where he talks about how one bad person can take up all of their resources and 50 good people can take up no resources. And my favorite sort of side note and the decision is when they have one of the Capitol Police captains admitting that when he knows the sing-along will show up, even without a permit, he doesn't assign extra officers, which is the whole point. What do you need a permit for if there's no extra officers? Let's see, we have one more caller, and then, Steve, I want to hear your answers to that.
All right.
Hi, caller. Tell us your name and your question.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, first of all, I've got a few comments based on your previous caller. The question was asked about protesting or picketing on the other side of the street. That would be a very wise move, and the reason is, as Steve correctly noted, this is city property, so even if you're cited or arrested by the Madison police, your case will end up in the Madison Municipal Court, where, for one thing, it will not appear on your record at all, and for another, if there is a fine or a citation, it will be for much, much less than it would be in state court, where you would be taken if the Capitol Police arrested you. I guess I also have a general comment. What's been a pet peeve of mine for many years is that I think the conduct of the state Capitol Police is indicative of the problem in Madison, where we have these large number of police jurisdictions, and all of them have relatively little to do, so they can be much more reactive on relatively minor issues than, say, a municipal police force like Madison would be. And I think the Capitol Police are typical of that. I think the University Police are also a star example. And then one final comment. This is tangential to the question Steve mentioned about a member who felt stymied because he was waiting for a decision on a security clearance. My cynical remark there would be that you don't even have to have a police record to be denied a security clearance. All they have to do, the background investigators, is come across a single person that's willing to say anything negative or derogatory about you, and you're pretty well washed out from any further consideration. Of course, that depends on the agency. And I'd like to thank you for taking my call, and congratulations on your at least tentative victory.
Well, thanks for your comments. I think that there's a bunch of interesting things in there, but I want to talk a little bit about the conclusion that the judge drew, distinguishing between 4 and between 20. So really the substance of his argument is having a permit for small groups does not have any relationship to the safety that happens in the Capitol. Let me read one more paragraph and then I'll be done. Defendants point to the enormous protests that were witnessed at the Capitol in 2011 as a danger. No doubt these fears drove the overly restrictive permitting process for small groups the court finds likely infringes the First Amendment. On the record before it to date, the court finds these concerns are overblown at best. While another protest like the one in 2011 might very well again interfere with the functioning of ordinary business, an injunction restricting the permits of small groups should have no practical effect on the policing required or the functioning of the government in the Capitol's four wings. So he really lays out that there's no relationship between the two. And then he concludes 20 is a good enough number. So talk to me about this, because you know what? Solidarity sing-along has more than 20 people on a regular basis. So it's a victory, and yet it isn't. So what's sort of your take on the conclusion that he drew? And then how do you address this? Because this is a preliminary injunction. What are you going to do in January to move this forward?
My take on it is that it is a very preliminary number that the judge chose. I think he was nervous, if I can use that word, about a couple of considerations. And one of them had to do with the role of a court, which is not to legislate. And so it's courts start to get nervous when they're in a situation where they might have to step in and rewrite a policy that's adopted by the executive branch, possibly with some approval through the legislative process. And secondarily, that it's just a preliminary injunction. And thirdly, I guess there's the third thing I think he was nervous about is, does he have the right to rewrite the policy at all, or does he have to strike down the whole policy?
Is he allowed to do this? So is the judge allowed to? Is that the law now, 20? Or is it because now the Department of Administration has come in and said, we will do 20, that makes it okay? And what if they hadn't agreed to it?
Well, they haven't agreed to it in any formal legal sense. They're not bound by it, you know, in terms of anything they've said is not binding on them. What's binding is that the court has said as a preliminary matter, the 20-person number is a threshold. I'm very optimistic that the judge's wording indicates that he has picked up what he considers to be on the low end of the appropriate range of numbers because of the concerns I was mentioning earlier, and that there's a very good likelihood that he would at the trial pick a much higher number, not least of which is because he quotes Chief Tubbs as saying that they can manage 50 easily without increased staffing, even under difficult situations. And
that's a low number.
Yeah, and Chief Reisling, the university police chief, testified that at Bascom Hall, which has a dome and a rotunda, they in a much smaller space, they accommodate 200 to 300 protesters singing like the sing along without requiring a permit at all, and without any difficulty policing at their normal staff levels. So, I think that there's a very good likelihood that the judge. I think what the judge is saying basically, we were pushing for a reservation system. He wasn't willing to buy that completely, but I think what he said is a permit is kind of an umbrella policy. The state better be pretty reasonable with it. That yes, at some number the state has a reasonable basis to request a permit, but unless the state can show that the permit has some kind of a substantial relationship to the end of the legitimate concerns about administering the Capitol, the judge is going to be suspicious of it. And I think what he said in the parts that you just read and the way the questioning of the representative of the Capitol Police at the preliminary hearing went, it was pretty clear that they could not. They tried to bring in evidence of some of the disturbances and difficulties that they've had policing the sing-along and related events, but the bottom line is that they can't show how a permit would have helped in any of those respects. And essentially, the argument I think is the most important, is that, you know, a permit for its own sake, you know, should not trump the First Amendment. I think that, you know, when and if a First Amendment activity becomes disorderly, if it starts to damage property, if it causes personal injury, if it reaches a certain noise level where it's disruptive, there are already other ordinances and rules that can be enforced when those things happen, and there's no reason to believe that having a permit would have will make any difference. So enforcement of it simply for the purpose of enforcing a permit simply for its own sake, I think, is very suspicious, and the judge recognizes that.
That's really interesting to sort of think about what's the point of having a permit in the first place.
Right.
We have a caller coming in. Will you tell us your name? Oh, did we lose me there? I'm here. Will you tell us your name and your question, please?
My name is Mike, and my question is whether signs are going to be allowed at the Capitol by this ruling.
Good question. That isn't really part of the lawsuit, but it is a very troubling area of the rules.
There is regulation of how big a sign can be.
Right, and how it can be displayed and other things. I think that was a big point of discussion in my private talks with Attorney Herman, where we really came to an impasse. I mean, the DOA seems very intent on regulating signs, and it's not part of, you know, Mr. Kissick's case does not involve allegations of him using signs, and it's not one of the claims in our lawsuit. But I mean, that's certainly another area that's ripe, in my view, for litigation.
For another case. So I wanted to talk to you about the whole idea of the permit process. Do you have in your mind an idea of when a permit actually does serve a purpose? If you're arguing legally, there's no reason to ever have a permit for the sake of just a safety issue, because the permit has nothing to do with safety and not safety. Would it be more reasonable then to ask for permits when there's going to be electrical needs or on a holiday, so there's overtime for staff costs? I mean, what are sort of the things that do seem reasonable for a permit?
Yeah, I think the most overarching reason I think that a permit would be legitimate is if there's competing demands for the space, or in other words, competing demands for a scarce resource.
But if there aren't permits, how do you know there's going to be competing demands?
Well, what we're saying is that there should be a reservation system where anybody who wants to be guaranteed the use of the space can go get a permit or a reservation. And then if you show up like the sing-along and you don't have a permit and somebody else does, then you have to defer to the person that has the permit. And on the other hand, if there's no competing demands for the space, then whoever shows up should be able to use it. And if this is one of the reasons why Judge Connolly came up with 20 people, is that a group of 50 or 75 might be easily manageable, but what if two groups of 50 or 75 showed up? Then what, you know? So maybe we need 25 should be the limit, you know? And so I think that's how he came up with the 20. But, you know, the reality of it is I don't think that type of a problem arises very often. And if it does, you know, Chief Tubbs was very good at simply going down there personally, jawboning, as they call it, talking to the people and figuring out solutions on the spot. And if you can't, then you know, then the police have to decide that for the purpose of public order, they might have to take some sort of action about who gets to use the space and who doesn't.
You're listening to A Public Affair. This is Carousel Baird. My guest today is Attorney Stephen Porter. We're talking about his recent victory in federal court to win a preliminary injunction regarding access to the Capitol. We only have a couple more minutes. I wanted to wrap up a little bit, Stephen, and sort of get your thoughts on, you know, there were some legal arguments that you made in the decision and in the case that Judge Connolly didn't, you know, latch on to. Do you think that you're going to sort of recraft some arguments, or, you know, set up a little bit for us of what we can anticipate in January happening? Will there be more First Amendment claims, or are you going to focus mostly on the 4-person, 20-person?
I think the latter. You know, the main focus of the case, in fact, when we first began, lawyers in Madison just began getting together to think about what we can do about this. It was my opinion from the beginning that, you know, we could probably get the judge to rule that 4 is too small. And even if we could raise it to 10, 15, 20, what difference does that really make, especially for the sing-along? So I still think that the point is basically, if you don't need a permit, don't require one. You know, the permit requirement has actually been there since 1979, and it hasn't been until September that anybody got arrested for it,
right?
And got cited for it, and the judge even observed the fact that we had tens of thousands of people occupying the Capitol in early 2011, and nobody got cited for not having a permit. And then when the protests died down, and you've got a stubborn group, if I can use that term, that keeps coming in and using the Capitol for speech, that by the testimony of Chief Tubbs, very clearly was easily managed with a normal contingent of police at the Capitol, and actually that in most instances was very cooperative. Why do you all of a sudden, for the first time in 30-some years, have to start issuing citations just because they don't have a permit? And I think the judge is offended by that. And I think that's why I said earlier, I think that if Chief Irwin and the DOA, you know, wants to really crack down on the letter of the law because that's what the judge says, I think they're going to find that the judge might not be too happy with that in January. And I think we can push the judge a lot higher. Chief Risling and Chief Tubbs both testified that a much another higher number can be easily managed with just the normal contingent of police that are on duty, and you don't need the permit for advanced planning. And that the state did not, well, other than occasional friction with a wedding or something else, there were very few instances where there were competing demands on the space that could not be handled. In the case of the wedding, it was handled by Chief Tubbs just talking to both parties and then the parties working it out, you know. And so the idea that a rule for its own sake, I think the judge recognizes, well, at some point, you know, I'm not going to say the state doesn't have an interest in a permit, but I think he wants to see the state being more reasonable in
how
they apply.
You have to connect the reasoning for it.
Right.
And do you see, you know, we touched on this a little bit, do you see other lawsuits coming up in the future addressing other issues in the DOA rules?
Well, there is the sign thing, and there's definitely the whole area of as applied is still ripe out there. So, you know, once we... I knocked my mic off.
You're still here.
Once we get done in January, I mean, there could be an appeal, as Pete or somebody observed, that could go on forever, but that the ruling in January will stand, unless typically we would expect while the appeal pends. But, you know, like I said, ultimately, if it does appear that the DOA has an axe to grind with the sing-along because of the content of their speech or because they're in opposition to the governor or whatever, if there's evidence of that, and if somebody digs up evidence of that, then there's a whole nother case of as applied unconstitutional application of the policy.
And those would all sort of fit under the First Amendment,
yep,
you know, lexus as well.
Yep.
It's got to have a strict scrutiny standard specifically,
right,
to very narrowly drafted. That, I mean, that's the legal crux of all this. It has to be very narrowly drafted if you're going to restrict people's free speech, First Amendment rights.
Right, and the same thing with enforcement. If you're enforcing a restriction based on the content of somebody's speech, you have to have a compelling interest to do that, a compelling government interest, and the means have to be narrowly tailored. That means very, very precisely tailored to just achieving that end. Because speech is so important to our way of doing politics and government.
It's the First Amendment of the Constitution.
It is.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I've had Attorney Stephen Porter with us here on A Public Affair talk about access to the Capitol, free speech rights to protest and rally and gather, and the success he's had at on the federal level, winning a preliminary injunction, and the next steps that we will have to keep the momentum going. Thank you for your work, and I wish you success in January.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank everyone who has helped out on the show today. Yvonne has been taking our calls, And Rachel Punzak has been my producer. Yay, Rachel. So thank you very much for joining us, and have a great day. Enjoy the sunshine.